From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR West in Culver City, California. Today, it's Here and Now. The Trump administration has ordered a review of the Iran nuclear deal. In a letter to Congress, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson acknowledged that Iran is sticking to the terms of the Obama-era deal to curb Iran's nuclear program. But he also said that Iran remains a leading state sponsor of terror and that the administration is reviewing the agreement's lifting of sanctions to evaluate whether it is vital to the national security interests of the United States. President Trump has been a harsh critic of the nuclear deal, calling it the worst deal ever negotiated during his campaign. Joining us is Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent. Hi, Greg.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what does this mean for the Iran deal to say on the one hand that Iran is complying, but also ordering a review?
It's a warning shot at this point. This is something that the Secretary of State, Tillerson, has to do every 90 days, so it was required of him. And as you noted, he says Iran is complying. But Trump talked very tough about this. He said he would rip it up, and he wants to show, or the State Department under Tillerson wants to show that they haven't forgotten about it. Now, so I think we're a long way off. This review has to take place, and this will take time, and we don't know what the outcome will be. But if the U.S. did reimpose sanctions, it would very quickly escalate. Iran would certainly say that it no longer feels bound by the deal. So if we do get to that point, things could deteriorate rapidly.
And what is it that Trump and the administration find so objectionable about the deal?
They basically think that it won't keep Iran from building a bomb if it wants to, that the imposition of these restrictions under the deal are for 10 to 15 years. Iran just needs to bide its time and could either cheat in the interim or go back to what the U.S. says it was doing, which was attempting to build a bomb. Also, they would say that Iran hasn't improved its behavior on other non-nuclear issues, that Iran is still supporting the Syrian government and President Bashar Assad, and that Iran is still testing ballistic missiles. But, you know, there are supporters who are saying, look, Iran is abiding by the deal. Boeing has signed agreements to sell planes to Iran. If you reverse course here, you would lose some of the things that have happened.
Now, this is not happening in a vacuum. This is happening while the Trump administration is also dealing with an actual nuclear power, North Korea. If the administration has been adamant in their opposition to North Korea's nuclear program, why would they want to abandon a nuclear deal that they have with Iran?
I think you should see it as the way that Republicans and Democrats differ on this issue of how to deal with potential nuclear states. The Obama administration and many Democrats very much favored the carrot approach. Their approach toward North Korea was strategic patience. Let's let this thing play out. We're not going to take any dramatic action or military actions. And with Iran, Obama pushed throughout his presidency to try to cut the deal, which he was a huge supporter of. The Trump administration, his rhetoric has ratcheted up very, very quickly. We'll have to see if this ultimately leads to action. But you see this very different approach of the carrot versus the stick.
How might Iran respond?
Well, this is a big deal, huge deal for Iran. The president, Hassan Rouhani, is facing a presidential election next month. He really staked his presidency to this reaching out to the world. And the centerpiece of this was the nuclear deal, which eased the sanctions on Iran. It's allowed them to sell oil, certainly upgraded their relations with Europe. It's been very, very important. However, many Iranians haven't really necessarily felt the economic benefit. So if the U.S. slaps sanctions on, and Iran is abiding by the deal but is not getting the benefits, it could have an impact on the Iranian election next month.
That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, in Japan today, Vice President Mike Pence had tough words for North Korea following its latest test of a missile this past weekend. Pence, on board the aircraft carrier the USS Ronald Reagan, reiterated warnings that the U.S. would respond forcefully.
History will attest the soldier does not bear the sword in vain. And those who would challenge our resolve or our readiness should know. We will defeat any attack and meet any use of conventional or nuclear weapons with an overwhelming and effective American response.
Pence made the remarks as it became known that the aircraft carrier that President Donald Trump said he had ordered toward the region last week did not, in fact, change course towards North Korea, but instead continued sailing in the opposite direction towards a joint military exercise 3,500 miles away. Joining us now is Eric Talmadge, the Associated Press bureau chief in Pyongyang, North Korea. And Eric, I mean, you're there now. Give us a sense of how the country has been responding to these elevated tensions.
Looking around the city and the daily life of people who live here, you don't notice any change much at all. There's no feeling of any great tensions. Life has returned to normal after the very big weekend with the military parade and the mass rallies. But on the higher level, inside the government, I think there is definitely an increased level of tension and an increased level of concern. Last week, officials told me that after watching the Trump administration since he took office, they've determined that he's more, in their words, more vicious and more aggressive than the previous administration of President Obama was. And you can see that from their rhetoric and from their concern that they are, I think they were waiting to see what kind of a president President Trump would be, and that now they've kind of determined that this is going to be potentially a more volatile situation than before.
So this is really interesting because we've been speaking with Korean analysts over the past week, and they've pointed to the fact that many of them believe that the significant change here is President Donald Trump, that he's something of a wild card in this scenario. Has that amped up the, you know, already militarized aggressive posture that North Korea has had for decades?
They are definitely stepping up their rhetoric, and I think they're also more concerned about surprises that might come from Washington. But one thing you also have to keep in mind that the North is racing really towards its goal of having a nuclear warhead that it can match with a long-range ballistic missile capable of reaching the United States. And many experts believe that could actually happen on President Trump's watch. So there's a new sense of urgency, I think, on both sides.
Yeah. Eric, let's step back here for a minute because it's not that often that we get an on-the-ground view from Pyongyang. Now, you've written about things such as like a luxury hotel that reopened after renovations in North Korea. I mean, I think it might come as a surprise to many people that there's a luxury hotel anywhere in the country. I mean, what does that say about North Korea?
There are actually several luxury hotels in Pyongyang. And there are, surprisingly enough, a lot of good restaurants in this city. And there's a rising number of people within Pyongyang who are affluent enough to afford that kind of thing and a certain amount of luxury. Of course, once you get outside of the capital, then things change pretty rapidly. There are people who are still living very harsh lives, and so the contrast is quite stark. One other thing about these luxury hotels and some of the nice facilities, when the media was here before the military parade, one of the things that they were shown was a mass rally. I think 100,000 people were taken to the tape-cutting ceremony on a new residential district, which is full of high-rises. But, you know, afterwards, officials were telling me that one of the reasons why they took the foreign media to see that was because they wanted to show that all these years of sanctions have not been able to stop this country from developing and from surviving.
Well, Eric Talmadge is the Associated Press bureau chief in Pyongyang, North Korea. Eric, thank you so very much.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Well, here in California, police in Fresno are calling yesterday's shooting of three white men there a hate crime. The suspect is a 39-year-old black man named Corey Ali Muhammad. Officials say he expressed dislike of both white people and government officials, including on social media, before fatally shooting three people in just a few minutes yesterday in downtown Fresno. Joining us now from Fresno is Jeffrey Hess, reporter at Valley Public Radio. And Jeffrey, officials also said that he yelled, "God is great," in Arabic when he was arrested. How did they decide this is a hate crime?
Apparently, during interviews following his arrest, he said that he really disliked white people, that he was trying to kill as many people as possible. During his shooting rampage, he even approached a car that contained a Hispanic family. Hispanic woman pointed the gun at them, but didn't shoot at them. And all three of his victims were also white. Valley Public Radio was able to uncover videos that he did for the local community access station where he talked about his rough upbringing and his conversion to Islam, but also touched on how he often posts controversial things on social media and is not afraid of the consequences of that.
But they're not calling this terrorism.
No, they're not calling it terrorism. There was a press conference late yesterday afternoon where the police said they believed that this crime was completely motivated by racial animus.
What do we know about the victims at this point?
So far, only one of the victims has been identified. He's a 37-year-old man whose name is Mark Gassett. He's a father of two and a husband. The other victims at this point haven't been identified, and the utility company whose one of their workers was killed hasn't identified that worker yet either.
And what are things like in Fresno today? Are parts of downtown shut down? How are people feeling?
There was a vigil last night by a group called Faith in the Valley, which is an interfaith group here in Fresno. They're very active in the community, and they really wanted to get out in front of any type of religious animosity that people think that at the time that this might have created, as well as supporting the families. This happened right in front of a Catholic Charities, and they say they really want to open because they're a kind of a pillar of the community down there, and they want to get things back to normal after what's just a really shocking and just unpredictable event.
That's Jeffrey Hess, a reporter at Valley Public Radio in Fresno. Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and since I'm in Los Angeles, we're going to do a special in-person edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Joining me here at NPR West is KCRW's Travis Holcomb. Hi, Travis.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Marion Hodges of KCRW also with us. Hi, Marion.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
And, you know, I'm sure this is not the most exciting place you have been in the last week because you both just came back from the Coachella Music Festival. And I have to ask you about that. First of all, Travis, what was there? What was exciting?
Man, like, if you're a music lover, it's like the Super Bowl. There's just so many acts you can go check out. I mean, the highlights for me were really the unexpected stuff. Like, I did not think I would like Hans Zimmer, which is sort of like, let's see what this is like. And we went straight from DJ Khaled, who had ASAP Ferg on stage, to Hans Zimmer, and it totally blew my mind. I mean, I don't really get a chance to go see orchestral music that often. And I think that's the beauty of the festival, is that you'll always discover new things there.
And Marion, what stuck out to you at Coachella?
Well, honestly, I had to head out a little bit late, so I didn't get to have the full Coachella experience this year, which was kind of a bummer. So I just stuck to my favorites. Daphne doing a DJ set is something that I will never miss. So Daphne is the side project of Caribou, Dan Snaith. And when he DJs as Daphne, it's a lot more cerebral and meditative. And he builds these sets so perfectly. They usually start very minimalist and just turn into this glorious dance party. So it's always good to see him. And then New Order, who are one of my favorite bands of all time, put on such a killer set. So I kind of ended the weekend with New Order and then a few minutes of Kendrick Lamar, and that was just perfect.
Who we're going to hear from in a few minutes. But did you camp out there? How do you stay at night at Coachella?
No, we were staying in the same place. There was a house in like outside of Palm Springs that we rented out for the weekend with a bunch of friends.
But some people do camp.
Some people do camp. But the thing is, it's like, it's so hot that as soon as the sun comes out, then you've got to wake up because it's going to be 90-something degrees in your tent. So.
Right. Those are usually the people that you see there as soon as the festival gates open, because they're just like, we've got to get out of these tents and might as well go see some music. And they usually camp out in the Yuma tent where all the dance music is because it's dark and they have beds.
And air conditioning.
And air conditioning.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to some of the music. And starting with you, Marion, you wanted us to hear from the London duo Public Service Broadcasting. This is called Progress.
Machines will do the heavy work. Men will supervise the machines.
You owe much to these machines. Horsepower, not manpower. Brains, not raw.
Now, Public Service Broadcasting, we should say, we're not talking about NPR here, but what should we know about them?
Well, they're kind of an interesting project. So, as you mentioned, they're a duo, and how they make their music is they basically create their own tracks. They start with an electronic bass, then they add guitars and live drums, and they put together this really quirky kind of music, and they use it to fit the clips that they're putting over it, basically found footage. So it's old public service information reels, hence the name. It's propaganda films, it's newsreels, that kind of thing. And so they've done one about the history of Everest. They've done a whole record about the space race.
And what is this one about?
And so this one is about about coal mining in South Wales and kind of how that industry collapsed, and they're using it as a metaphor for just a sort of global change and how things that seem great and progressive at the time can just go in weird directions.
Well, Travis, you wanted us to hear something from Kendrick Lamar's new album, which is getting a lot of attention right now. This is called Humble. AM to the PM, PM to the AM phone. Eat up your per diem, you just got to hate them phone. If I quit your BM, I still rock Mercedes phone. If I quit this season, I still be the greatest funk. My left stroke just went viral. Right stroke, put a baby in a spiral. Soprano C, we like to keep it on the high note. It's levels to it, you and I know. Tell them be humble. Hold up. Sit hold down. Hold up. Be humble. Hold up. Sit hold down. Sit down. Be humble. Hold up. You're making me feel really hip right now because I had actually already heard this one, but it is new and people are talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure since you're here in Southern California, you're going to be hearing it blaring out of cars at least a couple more times during your stay, but it's apparently it's the number two song in the country right now, and it's the highest charting song Kendrick Lamar's ever had. He just came off of his headlining show this past Sunday at Coachella, and he debuted the live version of all these tracks, most of the tracks from his new album, Damn. But it's just, you know, Kendrick has just come back with a fury. Like, he sounds like he has a chip on his shoulder with this on this song and throughout the whole album as well. And this song, Humble, is sort of basically telling other rappers to sit down and be humble and, like, bow down to my lyrical prowess. And a lot of people have speculated whether or not, you know, rap thrives on beef, and a lot of people have speculated whether or not it's directed at any particular rapper like Drake or Big Sean, or if it's just to everybody in mass.
Well, I also had heard some speculation that he released this album and then maybe he was going to release another album on Easter, a la Jesus and the Resurrection.
That was a rumor that went around for a little while.
Didn't happen.
But apparently he's got another album's worth of material in the can already. So I guess he's waiting for the right time to deploy it, or maybe he never will. Who knows?
What do you think of his new album versus his 2015 album, To Pimp a Butterfly?
You know what? There's not really a narrative through line on this new album. I feel like To Pimp a Butterfly and Good Kid, Mad City both sort of had that. This one, there is sort of like a there's a cohesive feel to the album, but there's not necessarily one that tells a story through the album. And I think that's one thing that makes it a little bit different. Also, I feel like the last couple of albums have had a lot more jazz-influenced production that he's rapping over. This one, especially the song Humble, doesn't sound like anything that was on either of the last two albums. It's more of like an 808s and piano riff kind of thing that's a little more stripped down than what he normally works over.
All right, well, Marion, back to you. Let's listen to another one. This is Moulin X with Love, Love, Love. They would have been playing this in the dance tent at Coachella.
Absolutely. So Moulin X is a Portuguese DJ producer. I came to know him more for his remixes. He's done ones for Cut Copy. He did Robin and Royksopp when they put out that great EP together a couple of years ago. And he's done a lot of original material. He has two albums out there already. He's working on one that'll be released at the end of this year. And it's just kind of ruling my world right now. Hmm. It's just pure musical sunshine. You can hear it's got that Tropicalia kind of sound. So I kind of think of it as like Os Mutantes or Caetano Veloso just got really into modern DJ culture and they made that track.
I love that phrase, musical sunshine. That's perfect for this.
Yeah.
All right, Travis, let's go back to you. And this is the British artist Yellow Days. This is Gap in the Clouds. I was just running around.
Oh,
So a couple of things I have to say about this. First of all, I love these artists, and this is kind of like Leon Bridges, where they it's like a throwback to the 60s. You feel like this could come right out of the 60s.
I could see that. I mean, it's also kind of a fusion of, it's a weird fusion of soulful pop and bluesy vocals. Yellow Days is a 17-year-old. He doesn't sound 17, but it's a 17-year-old named George Vandenbreck. And Gap in the Clouds, it's a love song, and he says it's about the euphoria of feeling amazing after feeling low for so long, which is like just Gap in the Clouds is just such a beautiful and poetic way to put that feeling. And he's only put out one EP, 7 songs on it, and they're all incredible. But Gap in the Clouds is my favorite of his.
How can he be only 17 years old?
I don't know. I mean, it seems like just bedroom production has been stepped up to a level where you're not just limited to a 4-track like you may have been 10 years ago, that you can do anything, basically.
Sounds like he's got an old soul.
It does, absolutely.
Well, Travis Holcomb and Marion Hodges, DJs at KCRW, great to see you guys in person. Thank you.
Good seeing you too, Jeremy. Thank you.
So great to see you.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Today, 5 major wildlife groups are petitioning the U.S. government to provide endangered species status for giraffes. They've been quietly vanishing from their African habitat in extraordinary numbers. This comes just days after another very different giraffe headline, the birth of a male calf in an upstate New York zoo that took the social media world by storm. More than 200 million viewers watched the live feed of April the giraffe's pregnancy and birth. According to Google, it became one of the top 5 most watched live events ever on YouTube. Well, joining us is Vicky Croak, who covers all things animal for Here and Now. Hi there, Vicky.
Hey, Megna.
Well, first of all, a quick update on that baby giraffe.
Of course. The baby's just days old and is reported to be doing really well. He's 6 feet tall and at least 133 pounds in one 24-hour period. He put on 2 pounds, so he's gaining weight. He and his mother, April, live at the Animal Adventure Park in Harpersville, New York. An otherwise previously pretty obscure zoo. But the surprise viral nature of this online sensation seems to have helped spotlight some real discussion and action over the plight of wild giraffes.
So let's talk about that, because it's a significant plight. The giraffe population in Africa is way down.
It's pretty shocking, you know, that such an iconic, recognizable creature, the world's tallest land mammal that can be nearly 20 feet tall, could be disappearing without a lot of us paying attention. Giraffes are experiencing what's been called a silent extinction. And the population's been reduced by about 40% over the last 30 years, so from 140,000 or more animals to about 97,000. And they're now considered vulnerable by the experts who classify the conservation status of species.
Okay, so tell us more about this action, though, today taken by wildlife groups. They would also address or maybe enhance that conservation status? Conservation status,
I've got
say,
you doing it.
That's
right. Right. 5 groups, including the International Fund for Animal Welfare, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Center for Biological Diversity are petitioning the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to grant endangered status to the 5 species. And this would provide strict protections, including a ban on most imports and sales here.
Okay, gotcha. So, but for the overall drop in numbers, hunting, habitat loss, what's really driving that?
It's both, and the degree of each one varies by region or country. According to the Giraffe Conservation Foundation, the animals are widespread across southern and east Africa, with smaller, more isolated populations in central and west Africa. The human population is growing, and with it, agriculture and mining and illegal hunting, roads roads are increasing, drilling for oil. Civil war and unrest add to the tragedy for people and animals. And giraffes are hunted for their meat and to supply an international market for bone carvings and trophies. In some cases, giraffes are killed just for their tails as a status symbol. According to those wildlife groups petitioning the U.S. government, the United States plays a major role in the giraffe trade. They say importing more than 21,000 bone carvings and nearly 4,000 hunting trophies, among other things.
I see. So I'm hoping that there can be some good news to end this conversation.
Yes, there is. So 3 of the 9 recognized subspecies of giraffe have had some population increases, and one is stable. And there have been initiatives for translocating giraffes, like one in Uganda, moving groups of giraffes by truck to protected areas to increase their range. Not an easy thing to do with 3,000-pound, immensely strong, hooved animals who are both fragile and dangerous. And the protections the wildlife groups are petitioning for could bring immense changes, too.
Let's hope for that. Well, Vicky Croak, as always, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Ranchers across the Great Plains face the monumental task of rebuilding their fences, homes, and herds after wildfires scorched drought-stricken prairie land across 4 states last month. Brian Thompson from Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media visited Kansas cattle country to get a sense of the challenges ahead.
Back on March 6th, Gina Kirk didn't realize the largest wildfire in Kansas history was closing in on her ranch until she got a call from her brother-in-law. She jumped into her pickup and sped up the hill where several of her cattle were grazing. As she herded them onto a green wheat field, winds gusting to 60 miles an hour fanned the flames quickly in her direction. She takes me to the spot where she realized the only road leading out of the ranch was blocked.
And when I turned the corner up here, I could see flames going across the whole road. So I'm sitting right here thinking, what in the world am I going to do?
Kirk's only option was to drive through heavy smoke across a mile of pasture. But about halfway to the highway, her pickup got stuck in deep sand. She had to abandon the truck and try to beat the flames on foot. As she ran for her life, Kirk stayed on the phone with a nephew who was trying to find her.
And he turned around down there and came here and dropped his pickup here, ran down there and grabbed me, came back up, and see how the highway is cinched black? It burnt right up on the highway right behind me.
Kirk says the fast-moving fire was only 70 feet behind her by the time she got to the truck. Back at the house, Kirk says she didn't realize she was risking her own life when she went out to rescue the cattle.
All our cows are going to die if I don't get out there. Not realizing how fast it was moving. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It was throwing fireballs. It was mean, ugly. It was loud.
Kirk had to be treated at a hospital for smoke inhalation. Her pickup, a tractor, and a few other vehicles and equipment were destroyed. But friends with shovels managed to save her house as the fire burned right up to it. And she lost only 15 of her 250 cattle. Still, the task ahead of her is daunting.
We have 45 miles of fence down, and it costs about $10,000 a mile to put it up. So that is a tremendous amount of money.
$10,000 a mile. And hundreds of ranchers in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and Colorado are facing similar challenges. 7 people died, along with thousands of cattle and hogs, as fires consumed more than 1 million acres. The Starbuck Fire, which started in Oklahoma and spread to Kansas, was the largest, but it was only one of nearly 100 wildfires that week. More than 4,000 miles of fence were destroyed just in Clark County, where the Kirk Ranch is located. Gina Kirk worries that she may have to ask her banker for a $500,000 loan to rebuild.
It's going to be tough. I've talked to several farmers that, older ones that are saying, is it worth rebuilding at this age? Younger ones that are saying, I'm making, you know, payments on cows that are dead.
Like Kirk, Mark Lording in neighboring Comanche County feels lucky to have come through the fire as well as he did. The fire missed his home by 200 yards. What's more, he lost no cattle, but he did lose 7,000 acres of grass and 23 miles of fence. Lording hopes federal assistance will help with the cost of replacing his fences.
I'm a conservative rascal. I growl at a lot of things the government does. The fencing cost share, it's overwhelming what they're willing to do.
That federal program can reimburse ranchers up to $200,000. But Lording knows of one rancher whose fencing losses are five times that amount. And Lording says ranchers have to finance and build the new fences first. Then they can apply for help.
We're going to spend between $200,000 and $300,000 to fix our fence. And we have a plan to get reimbursed. But we also know things can happen. And I will sleep better when we get reimbursed.
There's another reason that may help ranchers in southwest Kansas sleep a little better. After a very dry winter, the area received 4 inches of slow soaking rain over a period of several days in late March. Most of the blackened and barren land is turning green once again as new grass comes up, bringing a renewed sense of optimism, even though the task of rebuilding has barely begun. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Thompson.
Well, here's something you might not be hearing much longer.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. Donald Trump, Commander-in-Chief.
It appears Fox News will cut ties with its star anchor, Bill O'Reilly, after a series of sexual harassment complaints became public earlier this month. That led to more than 50 companies pulling their ads from O'Reilly's show and several protests calling for O'Reilly's departure. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now. And David, what's the latest?
The latest is that they're simply preparing the grounds for his departure to figure out how to make it work so that he goes without too much acrimony and how to replace him. The guy has been a money-minting machine for the Murdoch family, for 21st Century Fox, and really set the table for those who follow him, Tucker Carlson of late and Sean Hannity, to really flourish in ratings as well. So what do you do when you take the top-rated guy in cable and deep six him? You got to figure out how to make sure that people stick around.
Do we have a sense of what they would do to replace him, of who's in line to replace the person with the highest rated show on cable news?
I think it's most hotly guessing, you know, the most hot guessing game inside Fox News right now is that, you know, Eric Bolling, one of the hosts of The Five, a popular show at 5 o'clock in the evening on weekdays, has made it very clear he'd like to do that. He sees himself as the next generation. I think Tucker Carlson, who in a very short amount of time was sprung from a weekend show to 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock to replace Megyn Kelly when she walked away, has proven in short order to be a favorite of Rupert Murdoch, the patriarch of the company, who is personally overseeing Fox News in the wake of the departure of another guy who had been accused of a lot of things for sexual harassment. That's, of course, Roger Ailes.
Right. So Bill O'Reilly is currently on vacation in Italy. He was supposed to get back onto his show next week. He actually met with the Pope today.
Incredible.
What exactly changed here? How did he lose favor with Fox?
Well, first off, it doesn't help when you see all the major prestige advertisers fleeing. And, you know, it was a real strong echo of what we talked about and reported on when Glenn Beck finally, you know, said one too many extremist paranoiac theory for even Roger Ailes, and advertisers peeled away. You saw that here with Bill O'Reilly. You also saw that it was the face of Fox News, the most popular figure on Fox News, who had been tarred by the scandal, accused by multiple coworkers, credibly, of having sexually harassed them. And the reason we say it's credible is because he and his employers have paid in excess of $13 million to these women over the past dozen years to try to keep their complaints out of the public eye. It's hard to quite understand why you would do that. He has denied these charges and said he's only targeted because he's famous. He's only doing it to protect his kids. But it's a real black eye for a network that had been trying to get past the Roger Ailes sexual harassment scandal. The Murdoch sons, Lachlan and particularly James, said this is a regressive look back face for who we want to be at Fox. We want to see ourselves as a 21st century company. This is something that sounds like more from the Mad Men era and not a particularly nice episode of the show either.
I just want to finally ask you before we let you go, you know, how big of a deal is this that O'Reilly is finally on his way out?
seismic. A guy who's been really the lead star of the biggest success in cable news for the past 20 years, gone. And he's gone because of changing sensibilities. He's gone because his sexual harassment scandal occurred in the context of his bosses. And he's gone because the Murdochs will defend people loyally right until the moment it's not useful for them to do so. And right now, they're preparing to cut ties, to cut a big check, to get him out, and to try to put this chapter behind them. Too many women at Fox are appalled by having to work with him. Too many executives at other companies within Fox say, hey, this seems to be very different rules than what we would have to do at different parts of the larger media empire.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
Former New England Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez died of an apparent suicide, according to officials. He was found dead in his Massachusetts prison cell this morning, less than a week after a jury cleared him of a 2012 double murder. Hernandez was already serving a separate life sentence without parole for another murder in 2013. And joining me now for more on Hernandez is Ron Borges, columnist for the Boston Herald. He's written extensively about Hernandez. Ron, welcome to the Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, just want to get your reaction to the news that Hernandez was found dead, apparently by suicide this morning.
Well, I was shocked. I mean, my cell phone started to go off about 5 in the morning with various people asking me if I was aware of what had happened. And, you know, it's just a great, sad story for all the families involved, not just Hernandez's family. Yeah. It didn't end the way most people probably predicted. But I think the one thing you could rest assured, it was not going to end well, and it didn't.
Well, I mean, I think this caught so many people off guard because he had just been acquitted of the 2012 double murder less than a week ago. I mean, is there anything about that trial which may have taken a toll on Hernandez and led to this?
Well, I think some people feel that perhaps, and we'll never know, I guess, but, you know, Sunday was the second anniversary of his first conviction. So here he is 2 days after being acquitted. He's in the same circumstance he was the day before he was acquitted. So nothing had really changed in the great scheme of things. I think people on the outside, not living that life in prison every day, thought, oh, well, he's got reasons to be hopeful. But I think you're not that hopeful when you've been incarcerated now for 3 or 4 years, mostly in a room by yourself. You have to deal with yourself. And perhaps that was what became too much for him.
Hmm. Well, Ron, as we said, you have written extensively about Hernandez. And let's talk a little bit about who he was and going way back, because you wrote this fantastic Rolling Stone profile of him. And you said that he started off in that profile as a kid, as, you know, sweet and goofy in Bristol, Connecticut. So, like, what was he like?
Well, you know, he was a very sort of beloved figure. His dad would had some trouble himself as a young man, but righted himself. Was a great athlete, was the best athlete really in the history of the town, according to most people, until his son Aaron came along. Everyone loved Aaron, and then his dad passed away unexpectedly when he went for a hernia operation, and everyone has pretty much said Aaron was a different guy after that, that he never seemed to be able to sort of process what had happened. He never cried. His older brother was in tears much of the time, as you would expect. Aaron never cried. The only time he ever went to the gravesite was after the funeral. He never went back. And he seemed at that point, in the opinion of many people and from my own reporting, to get trapped at that point in his life. He was stuck there and ended up taking really some wrong roads and got himself attached to a lot of people that were not helpful to him, and he couldn't shake that loose.
Well, so tell me more about that, about the folks that he attached himself to.
They were the kinds of guys who smoke PCP and do some sort of petty crimes and oftentimes live off other people, as was the case with Aaron. One, Ernest Wallace, a 40-some-year-old man, old enough to be his uncle, living and sleeping on his sofa after Aaron became a successful professional football player and was at the site of the first murder, and everyone was pointing fingers, of course, of each other at that point.
Okay. Well, I mean, the NFL itself knew that there were some red flags about Hernandez, because you wrote that by the time he made it to the draft in 2010, right, that a pre-draft psychological report gave him the lowest possible score, 1 out of 10, for social maturity?
Yes, that's correct. And they also, the analysis also was that he liked living on the edge. And certainly that's the way he lived. At least a dozen NFL teams had taken him off their draft boards, even though he was considered a first-round talent. And he was not taken until the fourth round, which shows you how many times 32 teams passed on him, you know, three-plus times before the Patriots finally took him. And everyone knew the talent that he had. Apparently a lot of teams also knew the risk you were taking if you selected him, that there was no guarantee that he wouldn't wander off. This is a kid who was 17 years old, had been in Florida for 3 weeks at the University of Florida, was involved in a barroom brawl in which he bashed a guy in the side of the head with a bottle. Within a year after that, he was the suspect, not the suspect, but he was interviewed about a shooting at a club. He was not a suspect and never charged, but how do you end up in those circumstances?
Yeah, so it's interesting because you see all these teams passed him up, but the Pats, of course, signed him to a $40 million contract. Later on, Robert Kraft, owner of the Patriots, claimed to have been duped. Duped? How is that possible?
Yeah, well, I think he personally probably was duped because one thing about Aaron Hernandez, like a lot of these kinds of guys, they're like chameleons, you know, and everyone you talk to when he was in jail, Thomas Hodgson, the sheriff in Bristol County, said, you know, he was a master manipulator, which he was. He could be whatever he felt you needed him to be and he needed to be to get over in the moment. You need you to kiss Robert Kraft on the cheek? I can do it. You need me to pull a gun out of my waistband? I can do that, too.
Well, of course, today, I mean, in the strange twist of fate that life brings us, the Patriots are at the White House meeting President Donald Trump. They're Super Bowl champions. Have we heard anything from them about Hernandez?
They have sort of declined to comment. They came out publicly and said they were aware of the situation but had nothing to say. They've pretty much distanced themselves as fast as they could, and understandably so.
Ron Borges is a columnist for the Boston Herald. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.